You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Now, any week that you're trying to work out what the fuck is going on, you need the most expert of advice. And if you were this week trying to find the expert, the subjects on which they would need to be experts on would be football, Iran. Unfortunately, we couldn't find anyone who knew anything much about those subjects. So instead, we've got Omid Jalili. How are you?
I'm very well, Mark. It's lovely to see you. And
now, we're very honoured to have you today as well, because you're about to perform royal duties, no less.
For my sins, yes. I was asked to do this by ITV, who said, look, it's come from the palace. They want you to do it, because I hosted an event for the Queen at the Platinum Jubilee. And it was a horse show. And there was a joke I did, which honestly, Mark, you'll know as a comic, sometimes things, you work for a week on something, then something pops into your head. I think, yeah. Shall I, shouldn't I? The context was that she had missed the state over, the Queen had missed the state over Parliament, but she came to this ridiculous, well, this horse show, which we kind of made it. It was called a gallop through the monarchy, which is from Queen Elizabeth I, played by Helen Mirren. All the way up to the Queen Elizabeth II, and there were people like, you know, Damian Lewis, Tom Cruise. It was a star-studded night, and I played the Herald, which was the Herald is traditionally the person who is closest to the monarch, who connects her with the people. So I was doing jokes about Guy Fawkes Night, which was still our greatest failure. For most countries, failure is a disgrace, but for us, it's a cause for a party. And she's laughing. And at the very end, I don't know why, you know what it's like? Something pops into your head and I think, shall I? I shouldn't. Do you know? And I thought, no, do it. Because I had the final words. And I said, and thank you for coming, for choosing us over the state opening of Parliament. And it got such a massive, because it was like the elephant in the room. And she did that. She put her hand up like that.
What do you think? That's a royal. Do you think that's a royal, like, yeah, lad, bro? That's this man's. That's the royal way of going. This bro. This man's funny. You get me?
Well, that's what I thought. That was my interpretation. But the right wing papers were very, not very. They were saying what how awkward. I think that they thought that meant off with his head. And but I was told by Princess Anne that is. Is from the sun, which means look at the tits on him. And she went, that's the one. So we're going with that.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let's hope. Well, if I go like that at any point during this, then that'll mean look at the tits on him rather than off with his head. Because I'm not sure it's quite within my gift to order such a punishment. Now, we'll start with the important bit of all this. Right. This is complicated, as I know, with my life being the way it is, that Iran in the football is complicated. It might not be the most important part of it all, but I know that I've watched two of the matches with Shappy, and she's gone through about five different stages of turmoil with each one. Do I watch it? If I watch it, who do I support? Do I go and sit in the kitchen and ignore it? And so on. So have you been the same? What do you, given all that's happening in Iran at the moment?
With football, look, you have to say that everything in our world, you know, including football, is kind of interwoven with politics. And at the end of the day, you either stand with the voice of the unheard, or you continue to feed a system that cut their voice, because, as you know, in Iran, they've cut the internet. And it's really interesting that they've cut the internet, but the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, he still does Twitter. So people are angry about it. And they gather outside his house protesting. And they always ask the security forces, what's this all about? What's the protest about? Because it's not a protest. They're just trying to get the Wi-Fi hotspot. People say, Fazlur, do you have two bars? I've got two bars. Have you got two bars? No, I've got one bar. I've lost the signal. You know what? This reminds me of when I was in Wigan. You know, this good Wi-Fi bullshit.
That is brilliant. That is a brilliant idea. That's why they have to move that, to move his royal palace. His signal here is shit. They have to go on the roof.
Exactly.
To go to fucking Facebook. Exactly. I cannot connect. I have friend. I cannot see picture of funny dinner you have. Am I a dollar? I cannot get fucking signal.
But the thing is, that's what it is. Do you know what? I don't know if you watched last night. It was the Poland-Argentina game, and BBC did this. They did this little look back at the Poland-Russia game, the 82 World Cup.
Yes, it was brilliant. Solidarność. Yeah. It was brilliant.
It was a brilliant. Poland had a brilliant team. They had Zbigniew Boniek, and they were a brilliant team. They'd had, as you said, Solidarity, Lech Walesa, and it was always in the news. I remember being 15, and even I was aware something was going on. And I think this is what's going on with the generality of the public. They see Iran v. USA, and they think, oh, hang on, there's something tasty going on here. So I remember watching USSR versus Poland and thinking, oh, this it's a bit political, isn't it? Are they going to be happy playing them? And I think the game finished. I think Poland needed a draw and they got through to the semi-final.
Yes.
But I remember I remember Barry Davis saying one of the most politically charged football matches in the history of the World Cup.
Well, yes, just for people that may not know. So the Soviet Union, which was Poland was very much part of the sort of satellite country.
I think the explanation now, because even at 15 and even now, I'm not 100% sure what was going on. So it's good.
Well, I remember because I was very, very excited by it because I was a little bit older than you. So I was about 19 when Solidarność happened. So independent trade unions were banned in Poland, and indeed all of the Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union. And this independent trade union erupted, led by Lech Walesa, who was an electrician in Gdansk, in the north of the country, and by a woman called Anna Valentinovich, I believe, who was a crane driver. One of the reasons why the crane drivers were the sort of centre of the beginning of the of this sort of movement was because literally, right, the crane drivers, they could sit up the top of their crane and they could read stuff, and no officials or anyone could see what they were doing because they're at the top of a bloody crane. So Anna Valentinovich, a woman who was in Gdansk anyway. Can't remember the name of it, the town, but this movement erupted, an independent trade union movement, Solidarność, that I think 11 million people joined in.
Yeah, it was huge
in a month or something. Yeah, so. Amazing, and threatened the Soviet Union and the world, and then Poland played the USSR right at that moment, and then eventually, of course, the Russian tanks went in. And
if people aren't following this and remember the game, we just remember there was a lot of people shouting solidarity. There was a big bloke with a big Polish moustache who then later won, called Lech Walesa, who went on to become the president or something.
That's all
I remember. But I think it's perfect. You've explained it really, really well. So look. So that's the context of Iran versus USA, which, and actually Iran at the World Cup anyway was going to be huge because the big question was, is this a team that plays under the name Islamic Republic of Iran? And as I'm sure Shappi's explained right now, with all the revolution going on, which is the most wonderful, you know, it's the first girls' revolution in the history of mankind. And I always say that we have the suffragettes who were just trying to get equal parity with men. But these women, they want to bring down the government and they want to smash it to pieces because they know they'll never be, they're not just demanding their equal rights, they're taking them because they know we can't live in a world with reforms. No, this lot have got to go. 43 years of a brutal Islamic regime, which now we're calling them a terrorist state. And you know, they call themselves a terrorist state. They've had so many court cases where states have been trying to take them, they're trying to sue them for blowing up army barracks and things. And their defense is, we don't recognize you because we are a terrorist state, and they prove it and they win. So this is a terrorist state, all right? So for the people of Iran, what messages are the players going to give to show that they are with us? And that was a big thing. And before they got to the World Cup, they did do certain things. There was their striker, Sardar Azmoun, who plays for Bayer Leverkusen. He wrote an Instagram post that says he denounced the government, so this is terrible, we should stop it. And then he was made to apologize. He took the post down. Then the players together before a warm-up game against Senegal, they all wore tracksuit tops during the national anthem. You're supposed to take off your tracksuit tops, then sing the national anthem. And they didn't take off their tracksuit tops because they didn't want the Islamic flag being shown. So we got the messages that they are with the people. And then the way the regime spun it, they called them in to meet Raisi. And
he's the president.
He's the president, yeah. And he's the butcher of Iran. He's someone in 1988 massacred 5,000 people. He's the bloody president of Iran. So the players had to go there before like a send-off. And they did this doctored, the images went out that they were bowing to them. But that's also like when you get up, when they were saying the names of the players, they would get up and say like Ruzbeh Cheshmi, and it was him basically got up and he does that, which is also an Iranian way of like thank you. But they were like saying they're bowing to their superiors. So that's when they lost it. And there's a great picture I put in one of my videos that the goalkeeper bows. And then and the defender looking up at him going, oh, Jesus Christ, it's over. We've lost the people now. So even I thought they don't represent the team. But then they surprised us against England and didn't sing a word.
That was a very powerful moment, wasn't it? I mean, for people who don't know, that was, because this is some jeopardy. This isn't like some futile gesture. And I'm quite a fan of a futile gesture, but we've all done plenty of them, haven't we? Yes. Oh, do you know what? I kept my fingers crossed when I, or whatever, you know. But this was a futile gesture that's extremely courageous. And
it was, yeah. And it was. And they
refused to sing the national anthem.
And then they were rebuked. And actually, we're talking about futile gestures. When the England players took the knee, so quickly, I mean, they were embarrassed. They went down and Harry Kane was down and up in 2 seconds. Harry Maguire didn't even bother because it was a futile. You're playing against the Islamic Republic of Iran, a brutal, with a girls' revolution, and you decide to take the knee for anti-racism and inclusivity. It was something that disappointed us.
I wouldn't blame the players there. I mean, I'd blame the FA for that because you can't. No, I'm not blaming the players at all.
I don't blame the players in any of this. It's basically when we say everything's political, yeah, but you've got to make the right gestures. So. And actually, Gareth Southgate, in his, it's the FA line, because they've been told not to say anything. When Gareth Southgate was asked in the press conference, they said, you know, Iranian activists are begging you for some kind of gesture. Will you do a gesture in support of Iran? He goes, I'm not aware of what's going on in Iran right now. And we all just went, oh, come on. He goes, it's not up to me to say something. He goes, it's up. You're the one politicizing the team. And if the Iranian team ask us to do a gesture, they're never going to ask you. They'll all get put into prison. We will listen to them. But so far, they haven't said anything. Yeah, no shit. So we've got 87 million people screaming at Gareth Southgate. So that was a futile gesture, but fine. But the fact they didn't, the Iranian players didn't, that was powerful enough for me to realize that this team is with the regime. And during the game, they're all being heckled by fans have gone there from Iran to shout out, Bisharaf.
Bisharaf
means dishonorable. So this is a team that's 20th in the world. They're ranked 20th. They should have done better against England, but their spirits were broken and they lost 6-2. And I think we saw the real Iran against Wales. So what's happened is it's a very moving moment when Iran lost to USA, which is such a huge game. And I was talking about this because it was so political. It's not just historically the hostilities between the two countries. For years, because we blame it, not we. I'm not talking about we. The Iranian people blame America for a coup that happened in 1953, where they had a nationalist president called Mossadegh, and he got rid of all the oil companies who came in because people were plundering the oil. Britain and America were plundering the oil of Iran, and they said, "We'll give you a cut," and they never got a penny. So Mossadegh, who was this nationalist president, came in. I mean, ask Shappy about all this. He alone got them. He threw out the Brits and Americans, who then retaliated a couple of years later for $60,000, orchestrated a coup, and they got control back and they went back in again. So So Iranian.
So that's still very much remembered, the Mossadegh incident. This is sort of the absolute fag end of the British Empire when there were still people running the British state who just couldn't quite accept that we just run everything. Suez, obviously, was only 3 years later, but we run everything. This chap can't go around bloody nationalising oil all over the place when it's ours. And within the next few years, that's come to terms with the fact that
Churchill would say, no, these people are savages. They're savages. Yeah. We're there to civilize them and plunder their lands. So historically, there's the Iran v. USA, as it was in 1998. They call America the great Satan. Anyway, but this game was huge because this is where it's interesting. I'm talking as a football fan. I know that if Iran get through to the last 16, the whole globe who, like me, age 15, watching Poland versus USSR, kind of know what's going on, but don't really know. Then when they're in the last 16, every country in the world shines a light on. So we've got Iran versus Senegal. Let's have a look at Iran. Well, who are the people? What's the food like? What's the culture? Oh, dear. There seems to be a massive revolution and thousands of people are dying. Who knew? So that's a massive light. So I knew that the regime, and that's why the regime knew there'd be a massive spotlight on them. So what they're doing, all in the few days leading up, they're bringing in the Islamic Republican Guard Corps, we've got the IRGC, to put the pressure on the players not to do any symbols or gestures. And they've broken their spirits to make them lose, basically. And I saw that team were a bit disjointed. That they weren't, USA were there for the taking, but they didn't do anything. So there's a beautiful moment at the end of the game where Ramin Rezaian, who's Iran's right back, is with the Trent Alexander-Arnold lookalike, Robinson. They're hugging at the end. And they hugged for a very long time because the USA players came out and said, look, we were raised in different places, but I see these players as my brothers and we love them and we understand what they're going through. And it's just like a 25-second hug. It was very, very moving. Because
a lot of the players are black, aren't they, the American players? And
yeah, they're black. And all the Iranian journalists asking them about Black Lives Matter. How can you play for a country where they stick a knee on the neck of a black man? I mean, I don't know if you saw that. It was just
the guy who gave a fantastic articulate answer. He was about 21, the American captain. Tyler Adams, because they asked, because he said Iran rather than Iran, didn't he? And so they said, well, why are you mispronouncing it? Yeah. And he said, and then he really, it couldn't have been, if a playwright had written it, it couldn't have been better. Because he went through how we are trying to make progress. We were trying to confront the people who killed George Floyd and make progress and so on. That's what we are trying to do by educating ourselves and educating others, just as you have educated me as to the mispronunciation of your country.
Fantastic.
It was brilliant.
It was brilliant. And I think the American team, even before when they were advertising the game, they removed the Arabic sign, which was in the middle of the Iranian flag, which says Allah in Arabic. And that's that the Iranian people saying that is not our flag, because they're saying we had Islam forced upon us, and this is the symbol of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the USA team put the flag up without the symbol at the beginning, at the middle of it, and the Iranian Federation went nuts. They said we want USA banned because they're disrespecting our flag. So there was all that going on. So what's happened now is there is a postscript to all of this, which I think is very, very, very significant, was the Iranian people went out on the streets immediately. By the way, it's midnight in Iran. So they were partying till 5 in the morning because the great Satan beat the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they were celebrating. They were all excited. And then somebody got shot. There was one person, a 27-year-old bloke, who was honking his horn in celebration. One of the security guards just came and shot him, killed him outright. And it was very shocking that they would kill anyone celebrating, but they thought it was disrespectful. So they shot this bloke. And then the very next day, Saeed Ezzatollahi, who very nearly scored against Wales, puts out a post showing that this guy who was killed was actually one of his best friends who played in a football team with him when he was like 11. And he puts a photograph of the two of them together and saying, today my heart burns, you know, that he was a friend of mine. So even the, and that, and God knows what will happen to him for putting, for even mentioning that, because this has now sent a wave of like, oh, but the one bloke who was killed in the celebrations is best friends with our central midfielder. Are you? He'd be like, he'd be like our Brian Robson, or he'd be like our, yeah, he was a very good, he's a really good central midfielder, and that is what everyone's dealing with today, actually, because they can't believe this has happened.
Well, this leads me to my next question. Oh, just one quick question, just on that thing, because I had this question sort of about Bisharaf. It's brilliant. One of the wonderful things about language, isn't it? There's no exact translation for anything. So I was having this conversation. This was a moment, one of the moments when Chappie had gone, oh, I don't know what to think, and got out of the room. And I was talking, and her mum was there, who's adorable. And I said, what is Bisharaf? Yeah. And she sort of thought about it, and she said, it means bad morals.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's something really beautiful about that. What a chant. I mean, I'm used to sort of sat at Sellers Park with people shouting, you're shit and you know you are, at the Wolves fans. But bad morals.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Bad morals. Bisharaf, it's like the worst thing you can say to someone. You are Bisharaf. I mean, there was a guy giving he gave a video. He's saying, look, I'm a military, but I'm 60. I fought in the Iran-Iraq war. And they are now using artillery, which I used, he showed these machine guns that I used to shoot down planes. He goes, these people are using this artillery that I used to shoot down planes. You're aiming it at unarmed civilians, your own countrymen. He goes, it's so Bisharaf.
Bisharaf XXL.
Yes, exactly. So it's a big thing in our culture, yeah.
So the question here is this, and this is one of a couple of questions that I find it very hard to get my head around at the moment. I mean, I suppose we should just, I mean, there might be people who don't know. The spark of this and the spark of an uprising is just the spark. I don't want to demean it, but the spark of it was a woman, Mahsa Rahmani, was murdered by the magnificently named morality police because her hijab didn't cover her hair properly.
Yeah, properly.
She was going for
a driver awareness course. That's what they were trying to take her. Like a hair on the veil awareness course.
So, so the claim was that Mahsa Rahmani died of a heart failure by the most extraordinarily awful coincidence at the exact time that they were beating her to death, and she died of a heart failure. So, of course, you could claim that for anything. They could say, all the people we've shot, they didn't die because we shot them. They just all had a heart failure at the moment we shot them. Terrible luck keeps happening. It just a horrible, horrible, horrible state of affairs. So, yeah, clearly it's about much more than the hijab. Not that these aren't extraordinarily important dynamics, but it's about much more than that. But now this regime, clearly to this regime, it matters enormously, this. It's not just something that they can just fritter away, that they can let go, it seems to me, because these sorts of rules about hijabs, the Islamic law and so on, it's how it defines itself, how it sort of, we are a nation separate from the West and so on. And therefore it matters absolutely fundamentally to us that we maintain these medieval laws. They would also have no qualms at all about being utterly merciless. They would do what the Chinese did in Tiananmen Square and not think twice about it, but they haven't done. And it seems to me, I don't know if I'm being over-optimistic here, but it seems to me that the reason they haven't done is because they fear that the army would split. They fear possibly even that the police would split. They fear that, I know that there have been oil workers that have gone on strike, we believe.
Steel workers, they're all on strike right now, yeah.
So that's a dangerous time for a regime. And because it's happening in every town, they can't do what ruling powers often do and bring in regiments from elsewhere and so on. It's not simple to do because there doesn't seem to be any area of the country where the demonstrations aren't popular. And so it's a very, very dangerous, fragile time for these bastards, isn't it?
Yes, we hope so. So I didn't go, did you have a, are you saying that they haven't brought in the army? I didn't quite get the question.
I think that they have brought in the army, but they daren't, They then order an absolute massacre, you know, on the lines of what the Chinese government did. That's what I was thinking at first. I thought, is this going to go the way of Tiananmen Square, where the protests grow and grow, and then the army brings in and then the army just massacres people? That's what I feared. Now, that hasn't happened. It's not to say it's not, they haven't been brutal and foul, but they haven't been able to destroy the uprising completely.
No, and I think it's very interesting that we heard someone close to the government was commentating that before you get to the mass murder, I mean, they're already killing lots of people, but before you do the Tiananmen Square 4,000 people in a day massacre, they have said that child killing children is a legitimate military tactic to break the spirit of people. So you kill a few children, and then people say, you know what, I'm not going to go. And they've done that. They've targeted children. They've targeted, from the very beginning, young TikTokers, young girls who have been, there was a girl called Serena Esmailizadeh who was quite open and 16, but saying things like, why is there freedom in the West? We see on TikTok, there's no freedoms here. And they just weren't really having it, basically. They're the children of my generation. My generation, we saw this and we just thought we better shut up and say nothing, and that's the best way to go. But these children, these younger people have risen up. So they've been killing these people. Some of them is age 7 and 10. There's a guy called Kian Pifalak was shot, and he wasn't even protesting. But they're very happy to shoot people and to take away the bodies as well, so the families don't have to have, they're just denied a burial right. So that's where we're at right now. They're still killing people, hoping that it will quell. But unfortunately for the regime, every child they kill, more people. There's videos I'm seeing of children on their way to school chanting. There's classrooms chanting. It's kind of amazing what's going on. And we're at that standpoint where, as I saw with one video, where that you're just going to have to kill everyone. I saw one guy that was protesting, and then he comes up to security forces. He goes, listen, you're just going to have to kill me. So they shoot over his head. He goes, no, not over my, you got to kill me. You got to shoot me. And they go, pum, pum. They pump him with 4 bullets and he drops dead. And the person taking the video goes, oh my God, they've just killed him. And even that won't stop them, because you've got women coming forward, going on their knees, their hands up, because shoot us. That's what you have. You're going to have to shoot all of us. So that's where we're at. We're in the history of humanity. I don't think we've seen that as clearly in modern times, where the movement are now saying, we are peaceful. And if you want to kill us, you're just going to have to kill us all. That's what they're saying. It's incredible.
Yes. God, I mean, I don't want to be trite about it. It just reminds me, there's the moment in the Godfather film, isn't there, where Al Pacino realizes that the Cuban regime's about to, it's actually a very serious, brilliantly portrayed sort of moment before the revolution in Cuba. And
he sees
the Godfather 2, where one of the peasants is willing to die, and Al Pacino realizes, like, these people are. Now, I don't think it's always the case that when someone's willing to die, that definitely means that the regime's about to collapse. But I think here, after 10 weeks of these of this uprising, I think we can call it that, possibly even a revolution, then I think it's clear that it's not possible for the regime, even using all its brutality, to put this down. And people must have more than courage. They've obviously got an infinite amount of courage, but they've got more than that. They've got hope, because they must be seeing that the support is happening in enough places that this can go through to overthrowing this regime. Now the stakes are too high. Now this isn't just about a change in the law. They're not going to be bought off by getting a few extra school dinners or something, you know. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you 3% deferred over 2 years, right? And we will review again NHS spending. That's not going to be the end of this particular situation. It's going to be either there is brutality against the uprising, or this government's going to fall, I would say.
Do you know what? And that's exactly, they're sending those messages very subtly. Like when Iran beat Wales, some people were celebrating, and they put on the front pages of the state newspapers, women without their veils celebrating. And they go, oh, Iran beat Wales. And they put these images. And this disgusted everyone. Because this whole revolution is because a girl didn't show her hair. And you're now putting on the front page girls without their hijab. It's okay. It's okay to use it for propaganda purposes, but you'll kill us if you don't wear a hijab. So, so what's happening now? And Mark, you've said it really, really well, because this is where we're at. And what are they going to do? And I think that the first thing is to win the hearts and minds of the people doing the killing. Now, a lot of these people are mercenaries, and Hezbollah were brought in from Lebanon, who are not Iranians, because they're happy to kill non-Iranians. They don't mind that, because people say, who's actually doing this? Iranians would never do this to each other. But it's to win the hearts and minds of the people doing the killing. And we saw on a television program, which is filmed out of London, Manator TV, which I'm sure you're aware, they're very anti-regime news channel. And somebody, one of these security forces had rung up and said, look, we're in a state here because we're with the people. Most of us are with the people, because a lot of us don't give a shit and they're just getting paid and they don't care. But a lot of us who are Iranians, we are with the people. And they said, well, what are you doing then? Because you're going in and you're all beating people up. And he goes, we have to, because they'll kill us. Our families are being threatened. He goes, yeah, but what was all that about? When there's a video where they go in on 10 people going and beating him up. They run over him with a motorcycle. He goes, we've all got body cams and they can see what we're doing. So unconfirmed report, he was saying one of us was hiding his body cam. So they shot him in the head in front of all of us, to make an example. So we have to do this. And they were saying, he goes, we can't trust that we'd all stop. We'd have to all stop doing it. And I think this is when you win the hearts and minds. It's a very simple tactic, which is where the Iranian diaspora outside of Iran can help, because we're posting every day. I'm doing 5 or 6, 7 tweets a day, posting on Instagram. And it's like a massive wave of it. So these things, even though they haven't got internet, the messages do get through. So the idea is that outside of the country, embassies are shut, diplomats are expelled, and all the assets are frozen of that regime outside the country. People in the country go on strike, and then millions of people take to the streets, because you haven't got bullets for 2-3 million people. You haven't got enough bullets to kill, so they would have to put the guns down. And I think that's what it is. It's on many fronts, we're trying to get awareness up. So embassies are shut. And the other way, we're trying to get the battle for hearts and minds inside the country. So that's basically where we're at right now.
All right. Well, that's a very big question. You know, what can we do here? But it's a slight, I don't mean it's to be a sort of negative question, but I found it quite difficult. I think it's got, put it this way, I think if this had happened 15 years ago, I think that there would be various institutions sort of in liberal society in Britain and on the left, if we can use that word, who would have called for something. There would have been a rally, there would have been big meetings and so on. We'd have had someone come over from, you know, someone who was an eyewitness of some of the terrible things and so on. And there'd be 1,000 people there. And from that, there would be some sort of movement would have been created. And I think there hasn't been that. And I'm slightly surprised at the not being that. I wonder whether that's partly because there are sections of the left that see the Iranian government as being in some way a little bit of a opposition to Western imperialism.
Yes.
So that their support for the revolution is muted. And then I also think that I wonder whether part of the problem is that the opposition, the Iranian opposition itself, is divided. There are people who support a return to the monarchy. There are the Mujahideen, who I know came down to one of the protests, and you know, I don't know. We're about selling tickets, Omid. I don't know whether it helps to publicise a cause when the fucking Mujahideen turn up. So. I mean, I did get them to do the publicity on one of my tours. It was a disaster.
You know what?
The Gulbenkian Theatre at Canterbury, hardly anybody come to that one.
Can I just tell you very quickly, Sacha Baron Cohen Yeah. Before he did Borat, he used to do this act called the Mujahideen Touring Theatre Company. And he would do it. He'd go on with his Arab clothes and shout kind of communist, Islamic communist rhetoric in a heavy accent with one bloke at the back, no one laughing, and me going, ah! And then I'd say to him, that was brilliant. He goes, no, I mean, and he's quite posh. He goes, no, it's not working. People are not getting it. There's clearly a disconnect with the crowd. And up the pink. They don't get it. And I said, you know what? I think, but the essence of the character's there. There's you've got to do some tweak. There's some tweak. He goes, yeah, it needs tweaking, definitely.
And then it's tweaking.
A year later, someone telly with Ali G, and then a couple of years later, we saw Borat. But that was the character. So
So done as a character. But whether it's actually helping to publish, I don't think that's the main problem. But I think there are a number of reasons why. In Britain, we've not, and I think the sympathy's there, the support's there. I think as soon as you mention it, I mean, I'm obviously, you know, very aware that Shappy's been amazing in publicising, you know, she's done loads of brilliant, brilliant things and always creating a really, loads and loads of people who sort of respond to that. But it's not been organised. There's not been... For example, I know that in Germany, Berlin, there was 100,000 people on a march.
Berlin, yeah, huge.
Now, why can we not do that here? That's my question.
That's a very good question. That there's first of all, you know, while all this was kicking off and we were talking about it, we had Liz Truss was, you know, she was the prime minister for about 3 days, and all of that's been going on, which is huge. And in America, they had the midterms and the primaries, and everyone was distracted. And I think there's also, you know, there is a thing, we often see brown people going bananas far away, and we're just a little bit disconnected from it. I think that's the problem. That's why someone like Shappy's important, where I'm important in the sense that we're both bridges towards, you know, we're British born. Well, I'm British born Iranian. And I think it's important that we, finally, they got me on Peston, and I remember one of the MPs, there was an MP, just said, you spoke very well. What actually is going on? Because he didn't really know. And I said, listen, there's a girls' revolution there. And this was 2 days before Liz Truss left. I said, the UK government has been completely silent. Do you know what might save her? Is if she comes out and sends a massive statement in support of the women. He goes, I'm going to text James Cleverly right now. And he was on the phone to James Cleverly. And you know, a few days later, we had a statement from the UK government denouncing everything, but it's just not enough. I think that's the thing, and I think you're right. There should be a movement.
What we could do is get Liz Truss to be there, the Iranian Chancellor of the Exchequer, and she'd bankrupt the fucking government, and they'd collapse on their own within a week.
That's a brilliant idea. We need Liz Truss in Iran. That's fantastic. But I think you're right. There hasn't been that, and I've seen. I was checking on the Twitter of accounts of certain people, like, you know, Ash Sarkar, who she was saying, oh, the best looking team were the Iranian team. And I saw that she'd retweeted one thing about women. But a lot of that kind of the activists on the left have not really been that. You're right. It's been disappointing, you know. And
yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I think it has been. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. But do they see the Islamic regime is some kind of, as you say, some kind of hit because they stand up to America. But, you know, they are a terrorist regime. That's one thing that the whole diaspora outside of Iran said, look, we've just realized this is what we should call them. They are like ISIS. They are a terrorist regime. And they used to, they don't so much kill celebrities now, but they did back in the 80s. I remember my parents came back from the Royal Albert Hall where a big Iranian celebrity called Fawzi Farrokhzad, who was it was like the Jonathan Ross of Iran. He had a TV show. He was very funny. He sang as well. He went up on the stage and was like saying, this is a government where Ayatollah Khomeini believes that the sweat of a man who's had sexual intercourse with a pig is impure after sunset. So he's banging pigs all day until six. You know, and I remember my parents saying, "Oh, that's a bit much. That's gonna get him into trouble." And I remember thinking, "Nah, it won't." And they killed him. He lived in Berlin, and they killed him. Oh, they went in there, yeah. They killed our Jonathan Ross, which was the most shocking thing. He's still remembered today. They don't
do that. Fucking amazing now, joke, though.
It's a good joke. It's a good joke. Not enough to die for, but it was it was shocking. I remember everybody was shocked and think, my God, and that silenced it. It silenced my generation, for sure. We thought, oh, there's no
who's
way.
Who's the rapper, Omid, who's currently
Dumaj Saleh, you should know, is someone who is a brilliant rapper. And we always say, if he lived in America with those lyrics, he would be the most celebrated rapper in America. He's from day one. And by the way, when we talked about Lech Walesa was an electrician, Dumaj Saleh is a welder. Okay, he's just a welder. And he started rapping. And he made videos, and he was put in prison, and they put him out again, but he carried on. His lyrics are absolutely visceral, and he's in prison now. We understand he's been sentenced, and they think there's some kind of death sentences being put over him. And he is someone we're trying to get rappers. There's a few rappers like Chucky D, and all these people are coming out in support of him. So he is, if they do kill him, and they'll know they can't do that. If they do kill Dumaj Saleh, all hell will break loose in Iran. By the way, they are executing people. There was a big thing where I think it was Justin Trudeau said, oh, there are 15,000 prisoners and they're all going to be executed. And then all the... I had a right go at some of these Iranian journalists saying, stop sharing that. That's not true. They're not going to kill all of them. 15,000 people right now are in prison awaiting sentence. So I had a go at one of them. I said, excuse me, they killed 5,000 in 1988. They killed 1,500 in 2019. You're saying stop sharing it? I said, you're the bloke when the plane's lost its wings and it's hurtling towards the ground. You're the bloke at the back saying, stop screaming. We haven't hit the ground yet. I said, you idiot. They're going to kill people. And they started killing people now. Would you stop it? So I've had a one man kind of, you know, attack on journalists saying, stop sharing this lie for journalistic integrity. I said, you're the bloke where they said, they're not going to kill all our family. They're just going to kill my mum. You know, so this is a narrative that we're trying to stop of people saying for journalistic integrity, they're not going to kill all 15,000. They kill one.
Well, they want to kill 15,000.
They killed seven. They killed seven.
Yeah. That is utterly barbaric. I think they will. I think they want to. I think they won't because for the reasons you've said and the reasons we've been saying, which they fear that their regime is on the state of collapse. So I suppose the very last question, it's been brilliant, I mean, absolutely brilliant. My very last question is what should we do? We should organise something. There should be something organised maybe soon after Christmas where we book a room, because there's someone we can get who can speak. I'm sure if two or three people who had some sort of connection, you know, close connection, who may, particularly if they've been in Iran over the last couple of months, we get them to speak. I reckon we can get 1,000 people in a room, and from that we can.
What are you talking about? What comics do this? Comics?
No, I don't think just. I think more than comics. I think people want to hear. They want to hear people saying the sort of things you've been saying. They want to hear from obviously women who have been leading this uprising. Is there a couple of people we can get and we can fill a room with people who want to hear this and want to do something and want to send support to the... Because if you send support, it does make a difference, doesn't it? You know, people see that.
You're absolutely right. It's all a drip, drip, drip. And the more things happen in this country, the crowds are getting bigger. I mean, when we say, what can we do? There's things happening anyway every Saturday. They're outside the embassy and they walk down to Trafalgar Square and there are kind of rallies and they talk. And, I went along to one. It's very powerful. I put a mask on so people didn't recognize me. But it's very emotional. People doing the chants and they're speaking and it's all led by, you know, young people. I'm very proud of these young people. They're all aged between, seriously, 20 and 30. And they are young, dynamic, coherent people who are organizing. And they say, well, there's no opposition in Iran. And they say, well, of course there isn't, because they'll just put them on a house arrest and kill them. So there are leaders in Iran who are working from the back and they're leading all the operations. But I think in Britain, I think if some British people are going along to these rallies, and I think if more people can support them, which is what happened in Berlin, 100,000 people, half of them, I understand, well, not half of them were They weren't all German Iranians, but there were a lot of Germans there. And there's a football team. There's some football team that's come out who wants to play for the women of Iran. It's on the internet now. And these just German guys, we want to play for you. And I think they've changed their name. So those acts of support are huge for the people of Iran. And I think my message would be support the protests. Keep tweeting. Keep retweeting me. It's not like I'm getting more followers. I got a retweet from J.K. Rowling. I lost six. So I'm not doing it to gain followers. So I think if you just keep follow me on Twitter, follow Shappy on Twitter, and just get informed. I think once when people get informed of what's actually going on, they will be utterly outraged that we see what's going on our planet. And I think the big problem we have here, Mark, and this is what all socialist and left people and even myself, all of us, we understand that the one thing in the world that everyone is trying to divide us on is our fundamental oneness. And I think as humanity, that's the problem. We don't understand the oneness of mankind. If people get that, then people do get angry in Britain. Because I make a point in my show that people finally, after the Ukraine and a pandemic, we finally see humanity as one body. You know, like when you stub your toe, it really hurts. But the toe is furthest away from your brain sensorially, but it still hurts. So we're now finally seeing the globe. So what's happening in Iran hurts us. The patriarchy hurts men, which is why men are standing with women to bring down this terrorist regime. So this is what we're asking for people to change their thinking, to see more the oneness of mankind, get angry, and speak out and bring this regime down. It's a very simple thing to do.
That's magnificent. I mean, thank you so much. Incidentally, that about the stubbing of the toe, I quite often find myself hearing this sort of thing. We have a saying. Oh, God, this is a bit dangerous me saying this. I often find myself with various Iranian expressions being explained. No. Oh, what? We have an expression that, you know, the almond that is at the bottom of the bin is furthest from the orange peel, but smells still of the, and the essence goes out, and the butterfly that lands on the melon is the, what? And
yeah, you're not supposed to put your back to someone. Because, oh, sorry, my back is to you. He goes, no, a flower has no back or front. You know, there's lots of beautiful things. Yeah.
It's brilliant. It is. Yeah. No, it's brilliant. Anyway, I shall, maybe I'll learn Farsi one day. I've got it.
No, you don't need to learn Farsi. You don't.
I've got it on my to-do list.
And do you know what, Mark? I'll finish with this. And this is really interesting. And I think because you're a comic and I'm a comic, I think you should know this, because we all think that comedy is not that powerful. And as I got in my 50s, I realized making people laugh is not the end. It used to be the end. It used to be like, you know, I always tell the audience, please keep the laughter coming. It really heals my childhood wounds. I need the laughter of strangers to validate me. And laugh, people laughing at me was the end. Now it's not. Laughter is, jokes are like with you. You've inspired me for years. You use humor to make your points. So I can tell you now, I can reveal to you now, and I'm not bigging myself up, but during the pandemic, what I did was I got my Farsi up to scratch. I started speaking Persian. I got asked on even Shappy did it. There's a guy called Sina Valiullah who does a talk show out of London on a Dubai channel. It's called Chan Shambibar Sina. And he said, you've got to come on my show. I said, my Farsi's not good enough. Even me and Shappy were thinking, we're raising off Persian's not good enough. They said, just come on, we'll edit it. And I went on and it went viral. And then he said to me, do you want to host a show? I'll be the guest. So I did my first monologue in the Persian language. And it went really, really well. And then BBC Persian gave me my own show. BBC Persian is a massive platform, 100 million people. So I did this show. It's a short half hour. It's called Tonight with Omid. And it's a kind of hybrid between a studio talk show and comedians in cars getting coffee. So my first guest was a guy called Tehran, who's half black, half Iranian. And then we did that on BBC Persian and it went viral. And we got 120,000 comments on the Instagram page.
Wow, brilliant.
Amazing comments. And I said, is there any bad comment? He goes, no, it's all good comments. I said, oh, what? He goes, yeah, there's one bad comment. I said, what? They goes, someone said, Omid Jalili's Persian is shit. It's a bit like, it can only be compared to the English
spoken by Osvaldo Ardiles when he moved to Tottenham. He put in the cap for Tottenham. He goes, what a wanker. So that's the worst comment they had. So, but Mark, this is the interesting thing. It went out on BBC Persian is a channel that is broadcast inside Iran. Okay. Now, I asked them how many people watched it. They said it's a minimum 12 million people. We can't even tell, but it's a minimum 12 million people watched your show. Now, here's the thing. I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Baha'i. The Baha'i faith is a faith that is very much, you know, banned in Iran. And I was the first Baha'i on Iranian television since 1978. And a lot of the comments, people going, oh, hello. How come he's got a show? How's that possible? How did the regime allow this? How could that be allowed to happen? I never mentioned it. I just did a funny show. I did lots of, couldn't do knob gags or anything, but I just did it was a funny show. I haven't done an English, but I'll show you the English version.
Did you do the pig before sunset joke?
I didn't know. I was told specifically that I couldn't do that because I'm BBC Persian, so you can't do that. It was very well received, and people say, hang on, how can this be allowed? So within Iranian society, people say, that's a massive shift. So I'm not saying I'm the one who's caused the revolution, but it is interesting that the powder keg moment was with the hair, because people were thinking, wow, it's the first time we've seen comedy. Comedy is not allowed on it. So I think that fact that I went in covertly and did a comedy show in Iran loosened something.
Must have done. And when this regime falls, as we hope it does very soon, then the television panel shows, it will be like, over here, it'll be diversity. You'll have to have one Baha'i on every...
exactly.
On 8 out of 10 pigs. There'll be...
Brilliant.
I have to say, I'm much more shallow than you, Omid. I just still want the laughs. And that's why, to be honest, we'll scrap most of this and I'm going to replace it with an interview with Joe Pasquale.
Well, listen, mate, thanks for having me. I'm a huge fan of yours. This is a real pleasure to talk about.
I mean, it's been absolutely brilliant. And will you come back when they've gone?
Yeah,
when,
I'll come back.
When Khomeini is living in a suburb of Paris.
Yeah. I'll do a little update. Here we go. They're all in Paris and we're outside his house trying to get a Wi-Fi hotspot.
Thank you so much, Omid Jalili. A pleasure, sir.
Thank you.